It's to the best of our knowledge, and this hour we're talking about pranks and hoaxes.
He was an artful liar, it was true, and he had tried to be an artful murderer, but he wasn't a real artist, and he knew it.
That's Walter Kern, reading from his new memoir, Blood Will Out.
Clark loved to talk, but had nothing much to say, nothing of his own, which was surely another reason that he lied and plagiarized lies and recycled his old lies. He had 10,000 ways to tell you nothing. I felt like I'd heard all of them.
Walter Kern's book follows his friendship and ultimately his deception by a con man who posed as a wealthy eccentric named Clark Rockefeller. They were friends for 10 years before Kern uncovered the truth, that the man he knew as Clark Rockefeller was in fact a serial liar and murderer. Producer Doug Gordon got the backstory.
Walter, this all started back in the summer of 1998 with a disabled dog, a Gordon Setter named Shelby. What happened?
Okay, in 1998 in the summer, the Livingston, Montana Humane Society got in a dog that couldn't walk. It had been run over by a car, and it needed the assistance of a wheelchair. It was, you know, a dog that needed a special owner who could pay a lot of attention to it. So they put it up for adoption on the internet and got a response from New York City from a fellow who called himself Clark Rockefeller saying, I'd love to take care of this dog. I have another Gordon Setter. I have a private chef who gives my dogs four-course meals. I, in fact, live next door to Tony Bennett, who serenades my dogs sometimes. But there's one problem. I don't drive, so I can't come pick it up. And my private jet's in China with my wife. So what are we going to do?
Yeah.
They came to me and they said, you lived on the East Coast. Maybe you can talk to this Rockefeller character. And once I talked to him and realized what an eccentric he was, I made the decision to drive the dog myself from Montana in my pickup truck to Central Park South, or near there, in New York City.
Now, you didn't end up driving the dog all the way to New York City, and your mother, of course, had something to do with this. You stopped to visit her in Minnesota at the time, and you ended up flying the rest of the way. So tell me about your first meeting with Clark Rockefeller when you arrived at LaGuardia Airport.
Yeah, so I had a nervous breakdown, couldn't drive anymore in Minnesota, flew in to LaGuardia at night with the dog for the last leg. Clark Rockefeller had told me I'd recognize him because he was a dead ringer for the character of Niles on the show Frasier. And I looked around, and first I couldn't see him because he wasn't as tall as Niles, but then there was a guy in a pink polo shirt and a pink cap and loafers without socks, and he had this funny accent that I recognized from the phone, and he said, hello, Walter, you know, thank you, thank you. That's where the friendship began.
Can you give me an example of one of the most eccentric things that at the time you found charming?
Well, you know, charming or just interesting. He once said to me early on, I've never tasted a Coca-Cola, Walter. What does it taste like? You know, and my answer was brown and very sweet.
Yeah.
He said he'd never eaten in a restaurant. He told me that he'd gone to Yale when he was 14. His parents were dead, and he was kind of a child prodigy. He claimed that he was doing research into speed of light or beyond speed of light interstellar propulsion systems at a secret lab in Canada. And he showed me kind of a picture of the lab. It was really just a picture of a forest. And in the trees, he said, was the lab hidden from satellite.
And how did you discover that Clark Rockefeller was not who he said he was?
Well, in 2008, I'm in Montana working in my office, and I see on the internet that there's a nationwide Amber Alert. Clark Rockefeller is a wanted man. He's kidnapped his daughter from a street in downtown Boston after a custody hearing, and he has disappeared. I had been talking to Clark over the last year about his grief, or anger is a better word, at having lost custody of his daughter in a divorce. And because I was divorced too and didn't see my kids as much as I liked, we comforted each other on this subject. When I saw that he'd kidnapped her, I thought, oh my Lord, he snapped. And though it was a appalling, I kind of understood the level of emotion that might lead to it. A few days later, it came out that the Rockefellers were saying, he's not one of us. And I thought the Rockefellers were lying. But then it came out he was also a suspect in a murder from 1985, a gruesome, violent murder in California. And when I heard the details of the murder, for various reasons, I knew he was both guilty of it, and I knew I had been not just fooled, but in danger the whole time I'd known him.
Wow. So how did that make you feel when you came to that realization?
It was like walking out and looking at the sun and then having a big hand reach through the sky and rip it open, and you realize it's all a painting of the sky and the sun isn't real. I mean, it was like tumbling through space. I thought, my goodness, I can't trust my own judgment at all. And that was really hard on me. I mean, everything that's easy about social life suddenly became hard because I suddenly realized everything's based on trust.
Mm. Did writing this book help you exercise the self-doubts, the low self-esteem, or are you still struggling with these issues?
This book helped me in this sense. When I finished it, I finally felt what I had felt underneath and had covered up the whole time I was with him, which was fear. Fear of his disapproval. Fear at some level of what I subconsciously knew maybe was his violent nature. Fear of him ridiculing me. Once I wrote the book, I realized that once I gave him the power of believing that he was, you know, sort of from a better social class and all these things, I had feared rejection by him, and I was no longer afraid of it. Now I court his rejection. I know he loathes me, and the feeling's mutual.
Yeah, you attended his murder trial. Can you tell me about that, what it was like to sit in the same courtroom?
Yeah, so in 2013, exactly a year ago, I'm sitting in a downtown Los Angeles courtroom, probably about 10 feet from him. His lawyers asked the judge if they would address him and refer to him as Mr. Rockefeller during the trial, even though that wasn't his name. It was Christian Karl Gerhardsreiter, his original German name.
Yeah. And he was originally from Germany, wasn't he?
He was originally from Germany. He'd come over to the U.S. at 17 and started posing as a fancy guy. Anyway, he dressed in a blue blazer and loafers without socks, and he dressed as this fake Rockefeller. After he was convicted, when he came in to be sentenced, of course, he was back in his orange prison jumpsuit. So it was really something to see someone who I had thought was such a, highfalutin character walk in with handcuffs in a orange prison uniform.
You visited him in jail. This was after the trial or during the trial?
He was arrested for the kidnapping in 2008. And as of 2013, he'd been in jail the whole time and had never spoken to the press, never spoken to anyone. But the minute he was convicted, he fired his lawyers, and I found out that I was free to go visit him in prison. And so I did, and I resumed our relationship in prison.
Mm-hmm. You also asked him what the key was to manipulating people. What did he tell you?
Yeah, I said, well, if you're not going to confess to the murder, at least tell me this. How do you con people? How do you fool people? How do you take advantage? And he said, it's three simple words, all the same word, vanity, vanity, vanity. You play on people's vanity.
Hmm. In hearing your story, I can't help but think of Janet Malcolm's famous book, The Journalist and the Murderer. And in that book, Malcolm describes the journalist as a kind of confidence man, preying on people's vanity, ignorance, or loneliness, gaining their trust and betraying them without remorse. Do you think that's what was going on with you and Clark, or were the roles possibly reversed?
Well, it wasn't really what was going on at first. You know, when I got to New York after having decided I had to meet him because it would make a great story, I quickly decided I was not going to write about him. He was a real person. He valued his privacy. It wasn't fair to break the confidence of a friendship. When I found out that he wasn't Clark Rockefeller and was indeed a murderer, all of that went by the wayside, and I thought, I am going to put this down in a book. I am going to lose my shyness. I am going to tell everything I know about my relationship with him. And I felt liberated by that. So for a while, I was being a very good, polite human being, but I stopped being one when I found out that he was a monster.
Huh. Yeah. Your whole experience raises the question, can you ever really know another person?
You can know a person to the extent to which that person is knowable. You can't know a sociopath. You can't know a psychopath because there's nothing to know about them. They assemble their personality in order to manipulate others. They create appearances, but beneath the appearances is nothing but their will to power, to take advantage, sometimes their will to cruelly hurt others. So you can know another person, but you cannot know a psychopath. There's nothing there.
Walter Kern, talking with Doug Gordon about his new memoir, Blood Will Out.